everyone. I'm Jennifer Vine, President and CEO of the Education Foundation of Sarasota County and your host for Education Conversations, a discussion forum to share innovative and relevant thoughts, research, and ideas on education today and to help prepare students to thrive. We just wrapped up our first season of Education Conversations, and I want to thank you so much, listeners, for following us through our first year and welcome you to one of two recap podcasts from season one. Today, we've compiled clips from several of last season's great guests who talked with me about leadership in education. And you all know leadership evolves, right? And so before we address leadership, I want to lay down some context in regard to some of the changes we've seen in education in the past 10, 15, maybe, gosh, even 20 years. So from our podcast titled Leadership in Education, we had Sarasota County's Chief of Middle Schools, Dr. Brandon Johnson, who pinpointed some of the more significant changes over these years, and also just as important, what has not changed.
So I think if you visited classrooms even 10 years ago in Sarasota, the one thing that you would notice right away is tech-active classrooms, right, where technology is right at their fingertips, and we use active boards in essentially every class. So if someone that's listening hasn't been in classrooms recently, we don't really use whiteboards or chalkboards, right? Everything's an interactive board and touchscreen. So right away, you see that difference of watching kids interact. But to be very fair, that means teachers had to change. So even veteran teachers over time that maybe utilize those resources have had to be trained to actually not only use technology, but then how do kids use it when they leave here, right? How do you assign homework? How do you assign lessons? How do you get them to interact with these products when now and everything seems to be more technology based? Another piece I think really for teachers is how they communicate with students, right? The reality is, you don't necessarily have to use certain social media platforms, but you have to have some connection with them so that they understand that you know where they're coming from. Those pieces to me have had made teachers kind of adapt and change over time. And I would argue, do a better job of making sure we're meeting the needs of students. Because at the end of the day, that's why we're here.
So would you say then that you've seen a lot of the changes in the technological front, but some of the enduring practices have been the connections and the relationships?
100%. Just had a discussion with some of the middle school principals. Things may change quite a bit, and we can even talk about from core curriculum right to instruction to standards, everything that comes down. The one thing that won't change is if you don't build a relationship with a student, it's kind of hard to connect with them, and it's even harder for them to connect with you. If every day they come in, you're not greeting them, talking to them, or something as simple as knowing their name. So we can have all these changes over 20 years almost that I've been in education, and that's the one thing that I've seen that has not changed.
So interestingly, we're back to a common theme in our education conversations, and that's relationships and the importance of good, trusting relationships with teachers, leaders, and students. But the way we foster those relationships has changed as well. And so in the podcast titled Students Today, a K-8 perspective, we had Carrie Johnson, an Education Foundation board member who's also Sarasota County Schools District Program Specialist. She brought up some unexpected changes she has seen in students that impacts the way teachers might engage in their classrooms.
Gosh, when I think back to the beginning of my career and compare it to my last year in the classroom, students and just education in general is completely different. When I started teaching, we had rest time, we had more creative play time embedded in our day, and ending, it was definitely, we pushed them more, the expectations were greater, and just in general, students were just different. I think a lot of that was because of some of the technology that is at their hands and accessible to them today. But really, pertaining to technology specifically, I noticed they came in with not as strong capabilities with fine motor skills, being able to use scissors or crayons or hold pencils. And personally, I relate that to, you know, they're used to using iPads and phones and technology, and they're just using a finger to scroll. So, and again, just with them being different, I think that students are used to seeing screens and bright colors, and it's easy and fun to stay engaged in that. And then that doesn't always translate to the classroom when you're just standing and or sitting and listening to a person. We're not as engaging, and it's just harder to keep students engaged for long periods of time.
So now that we've taken a look back and have an understanding of how education has evolved, why don't we turn now to where are we currently and where are we heading? And I sat down with Superintendent Terry Connor shortly after he entered into his new role, and he had a fascinating perspective on where education is today and where he sees us heading in the future. So listen to this.
You know, I would say change is difficult, and when you look at especially over the last few years, this shortage that we're facing in the teaching force, and not just in teaching, but bus drivers and all of the critical human capital it takes to run a school effectively, concerns me. Even our leadership pipeline and what's coming up and what we're able to have sitting on the bench ready to take on these leadership roles in our schools, very much concerning. I would say education has become a business with the advent of school choice,
right?
Which was good. You know, let's be competitive. Let's make our traditional public schools the number one choice in that market. Without people, because it is a people business, it's very hard to do. And so I think for me, my biggest concern is making sure that we have highly qualified staff who are motivated, who are well compensated to do this hard work that it takes every single day. Is my biggest worry, but I'm hopeful. I am hopeful. At the same vein, I am hopeful that while it may have seemed like education has been attacked over the last few years, that people are seeing the detrimental effects of that, and we're going swinging the pendulum back the other way and making sure that we're honoring those who are doing this work, and that it is attracting more highly qualified people to want to stay in this work. I'm always kind of that glass half full type of personality. And so I want to make sure that while education has had some challenges over the last few years in terms of recruitment and retention, that tide will change. And I think it starts with culture. And I think we have to respect those who are in the field and honor that work and compensate that work so that people have a livable wage. And so, you know, hopefully over the next few years that we'll start to see the pendulum swing back and people coming back into the profession to do this calling.
I think that's a great assessment. Do you see education looking differently 5-10 years out, as well as trying to also, you know, foster back the value that teachers play in the community? I think that will never go away. I'm kind of the mindset that is that's the secret sauce, if you will, is a highly effective teacher will always make the difference in the classroom and to a student. But do you see the shape and the scope of what public education, a school day, looks like? Do you see that being different 5-10 years out? I'm just kind of curious.
You know, I would like to say yes. I'd like to say that we should think innovatively around educational choice offerings for our students, and that the way that we do business today is not necessarily the way we need to be doing business. You know, I look at the possibilities of kind of a competency-based learning approach where you see students who can move faster if they need to move faster, and this sitting in a class of 22 for 180 school days for a certain amount of seat time is not necessarily the approach we need to look at as we move forward over the next 5 to 10 years. I think that shift's gonna be slow, but you can already see with HB1 and the school choice landscape of how that's working, that it's gonna provide a little more of that flexibility to think in terms of these innovative approaches. So I'm looking forward to that, and I think we need to embrace that. That's why I'm very optimistic about the state legislators going into this session around some deregulation of traditional public schools, because we should be on the same playing field. Whether you're a charter school, a private school, or a public traditional school, district managed, we should all have the same rules to play by. And so whatever is afforded in terms of flexibility for a charter or another choice program, we in public traditional schools should have that same flexibility as well. And I think the legislature is seeing that. And I'm hopeful that we'll see some headway in that
area. I think you are spot on with that. I think they're also seeing a nod to that. And I believe that's one of your legislative priorities going into this legislative session.
Since this podcast was first recorded, it's always good to just kind of see how history plays out. And we saw that the state legislature passed several new bills that have an overarching focus on the continued expansion of school choice, along with deregulation that gives school districts more autonomy. So Terry Connor certainly was very forethought in his message. So these new bills go into effect July 1st. So I think that's really interesting. So Superintendent Connor, he also recognized the importance of innovation in education. And this is a topic that we're passionate about here at the Education Foundation, and our current board chair, Brock Leach, who is an advocate of providing tools and innovation that will strengthen skills in students. He really looks at the opportunities for where our students are when they graduate. So he talks about why this endeavor is so important to him and also to us. So listen to him.
Well, I think one of the things you and I both learned from talking to folks in the community is that people make assumptions that what they grew up with in terms of support is happening for kids today, mm-hmm. and it's happening in the schools. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the reality that we live into right now. The reality is that half of the kids in our county are kids that are low income. Mm-hmm. The reality is that their parents are quite often very busy working. Many of them have single parents. The reality is that they're disconnected from a lot of other networks that might support kids in figuring out who they are and who they're meant to be in the world. And so the school district can't do all of that by itself. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do is create that community support system mm-hmm. That many of us benefited from naturally when we grew up. But it, you know, you have to realize it doesn't really exist for kids right now. Not only that, but they're confronted with all kinds of conflicting messaging and expectations through social media. You know, they're exposed to things that I was never exposed to mm-hmm. As an adolescent. So I think for most people, it's realizing that what we're doing today really isn't enough. What we have to do is knit together a network of supports for kids to really understand who they are and what they're meant to be and achieve their full potential. And none of us can do that by ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, we need a network of people around mm-hmm. us to do that.
You know, it's so interesting. One school of thought that I've often been referencing as we've been talking about that network solution is I have found the comparison to concierge physicians to be a similar comparison, because a lot of times people understand United States healthcare, while we have an abundance of wonderful, very specialized care and medicine available and physicians who can do such great work, oftentimes, particularly those who may be low income or marginalized, underserved people, may be going to, at best, I'm just giving a very general response by knowing, you know, I'm not trying to give too much indictment on this, but they may walk into an urgent care center as their best, highest level of care that they can receive. And yet what the concierge physician provides for those who can afford those services is that person is the driver of creating the connective tissue to all of the different symptoms that a patient may be having, and then finding them and pointing them in the direction of the best resource to take care of that. And so you get this level of care that is more individualized and personalized to your needs than what the mass level of care might be able to offer. And so I think that has been a place that I've been trying to kind of move in terms of sharing the imagination of, if we had a network solution in our community that can help support students, this is something that it could look like. So I don't know if that resonates with you at all.
I think that's actually a terrific analogy. I spent some time working as a chaplain at Tampa General Hospital for a couple of years, and I saw exactly what you're talking about. A whole bunch of specialists who really know what they're doing, but they're not, no one has the time to step back and look at the whole picture.
Right.
And help guide patients and families. I think that that's really apt. I think the part of that analogy that is most compelling to me is the idea of a trusted person who's yes. looking at with whom you have a relationship, who is really seeing the larger picture of where you are and where you could go.
Yeah.
And it, to me, that's the key missing ingredient. You know, in smaller, particularly private schools, mm-hmm. that's what parents pay for. They pay for the ability to have teachers know who the students are and know that they're valued and spend the time with
them. Right,
right. And that to me is, we need to figure out a way to instill that for all of our students. Yeah, you know, they can't just be the folks that can afford private schools.
And again, you hear that word relationships keeps resurfacing. And then Brock and I talked about the role of education foundations in being that equalizing innovative hub. It's that connector available to schools for each and every student and teacher. And then we had Dr. David Moore, the president of Moore Strategic Consulting, who has his finger on the pulse of education and leadership across the country, having worked himself with education foundations for over 20 years. His perspective on the role of education in our society is both interesting and, dare I say, also provocative.
I've actually always believed that education is a reflection of what's happening in society, and schools reflect what's happening in kids' lives and in their families. People didn't want to talk to me in education policy school when I would argue schools aren't as important as you think they are. Schools actually reinforce what kids walk in the door with. I know it's not a favorite thing to say because a lot of people believe schools and education is how you change people's trajectories. And I don't disagree with the basic point. I know people whose education changed their lives. But more often than not, education reinforced the life they were already set on a path to have. And that goes both directions. Schools and education reinforce things that are in society. And so I think the transformations of our society in the last decade, from how we relate to each other, for how we acquire information, for how we share information, for how we feel about ourselves, are fundamentally at play in educational systems and structures. And those systems and structures were built in an era that didn't have those other things happening, right? So, you know, we have schools that were built when you had to go to school to have access to information. Right. You don't have to go to school to have access to information, right? My kids solve more problems with YouTube than they've ever learned how to solve at school. Like, I hate to say that. My kids go to great schools, but they just do. Mm-hmm. So what we need schools for, what we desperately need, educational structures that help people mature and grow and learn how to handle information and learn how to relate to people and learn how to, but the how well we can adapt current things versus grow new things, I think, is the fundamental question that shows up in all sorts of ways right now in education.
And like Brock, David is interested in how we can work to provide equal opportunities for all students.
You know, there's a great article recently that used the phrase unbundling, mm-hmm. right? That we're starting to sort of pull apart education into parts and pieces. And there's another phrase that's getting used, which is called the assembly of education, mm-hmm. right? How do we assemble mm-hmm. education? And what's always been true is that people with lots of money have always assembled education from go to this school for these things, go to these sports teams, go to these rec clubs, go to these music lessons. Like, so how do we actually build structures that let more people more equitably access all that kind of assembly of parts and pieces? And what does it mean to unbundle? So one simple thing is, like, could a school district today tell you what the cost per student per algebra class is? Like, because that's what it's going to require, mm-hmm. that we sort of can unbundle the pieces and reassemble them in different mixed matches. And I think we're going to need intermediaries. We're going to need groups in communities who can help families and organizations create those connections for folks.
Are you seeing any success stories yet nationally that are moving into that unbundling and assemblage?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are well-known charter networks, the big picture company and those high schools. I think there are pockets of school districts with innovations like this. There's some great work in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that matches this from a district level. There are some states innovating with going to competency-based diplomas instead of seat time diplomas. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a fundamental requirement for this, is let's stop counting attendance mm-hmm. as how you get a diploma and count, you know, can you show me you did something? So I think there's parts and pieces are showing up with success.
He brought it closer to home when he presented how organizations like education foundations can not only be a necessary bridge to the community, but catalysts for innovation and change.
Well, first and foremost, we got to find a way to have conversations that aren't so fraught with, what's the word I want to use, sense of victimness, mm-hmm. How I've been harmed by something, or how it might be harming my children. And I hear that on all sides of the continuum, but there's this notion. So we've got to have different conversations about what it means to learn and what we need schools for. I mean, look, we still need schools to be childcare. Like, the economy doesn't work if kids don't go somewhere during the day while their parents work. Like, we're not going to have a bunch of six-year-olds sitting at home with Zoom without parents, and we need parents at work to have an... Like, so right. There are some practical realities to why schools are still really important to a larger societal infrastructure. We still need places for young people to gather with people who aren't like them. Mm-hmm. I mean, my brother homeschools his children, and they do homeschooling in a cooperative, partly because they want their kids to have social time with other kids, like right. By design, right? So we got to have those conversations. And we're not really in the moment in most of our communities in an environment where that conversation is ready to be had. I think we're finding places where people are starting to figure out, okay, let's get back to some fundamentals and build this in a way that's equitable. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the folks at Education Reimagined, a national nonprofit, are really saying, this is coming, and we have to be intentional about it, and we have to do it in a way that's for everyone. Mm-hmm. And that should be possible. So let's actually talk about that, not some of these other distractions right in the conversation. And so I think it's going to take some time, but we're going to have to figure out how to do that.
I think you're tying into the things that the Education Foundation here in Sarasota County cares about, and even why we started this Education Conversations podcast, because we do agree what your own observation is that there are many strong vested stakeholders that have deep values and thoughts and opinions on what education should do either for their child or for our community. So bringing them all together in a respectful way, again, I agree. That's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time, but it is necessary to do that. So let me bring it back then to the efficacy of just the role of local education foundations and how they're different. And you work with several different ones, not only, again, in Florida, but across the nation. You were involved in a research project that talked about the mixed program portfolios and the impact that they make. Can you share kind of what you learned from that research project?
Yeah, so what we learned in the Florida project, but it echoed across the other places I've worked and spent time, and whether they have the name foundation in them or not, they're these educational organizations that sort of sit in a connective place. You know, we need organizations that are doing real work every day with students or teachers, something meaningful, whether it's mentoring programs like Take Stock or direct student support programs like you all do here. And that work, the work of the direct student work, is what gives them sort of tangible on-the-ground experience, exposure, and credibility, but also leverages their relationships into conversations with other folks who do student-facing work, the schools themselves, Boys and Girls Clubs, all the other players in town, to say, look, how do we sort of talk together about what we're learning and what could be different? And how can we try something new? Like, I think one of the most powerful things that we learned in the research is that doing, you know, on the ground work gives organizations the capacity and skill to then try out interesting new things, right? So one of the things the education foundations in Florida have often talked about is, you know, education foundations can actually give school districts cover. They can take a risk a school district can't. Like, oh, there's a cool, interesting program. Let's let the education foundation help pilot it. And let's figure out if it matters. Let's collect data on it. And then the school district can learn as a partner without having to, you know, take tax dollars to go implement a brand new program that's never been tested in their community, right? So I think it's the combination of direct work, sitting in a small, nimble way to be innovative and creative because you're not managing a big behemoth, mm-hmm. and being connected to the other organizations in town. The work you all do with Planet and other education foundations do with local college access networks or other collective impact style efforts are really fundamental. There are a number of communities where I work where the organization that does that work, that puts people on the table, is actually the only one in town doing it. And they're often looked at as the only one who could do it. They're actually neutral enough, they're trusted, they have actual credibility. If a community doesn't have that, it's actually behind. Like, I go into communities and if I can't find that organization, We have to start to talk about how to build that organization, because you need that sort of in-between bridge, doer, innovator, convener to pull this kind of stuff off, to change things.
So everyone, this is a good place to end today's podcast. And David makes a great final point in that the leadership and the future of education really does lie within community. It's the collective efforts of the schools, the teachers, administrators. It's also policymakers and parents and the local residents and the community members and organizations, even just like the Education Foundation, and certainly many, many more. Those who really care about the success of our students can work together to lead us forward as the world and education will continue to change. It's an exciting time to be in this business. I love it every day, and I certainly hope we all can continue to galvanize our efforts together. So everyone, I hope you enjoyed this highlight podcast from season one. Thank you so much for listening and supporting our inaugural year. I think hopefully we're getting a little bit better at riding the bike, and we're certainly excited about what's coming up for season two starting in August. So just remember, you can check us out and tune in to all of that by visiting our website at edfoundationsrq.org. Everyone, it's been a pleasure and a joy. And this is Jennifer Vine signing off for the Education Foundation of Sarasota County.